Well, this isn't really budget. It's a social engineering document. It's unlike any budget that we've ever seen before. It's an attack upon women. It's attack upon reproductive rights. It's basically puts up a, you know, whites only sign for the state of New Hampshire.
Welcome to another edition of the New Hampshire Journal podcast, made possible by the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, where you will find slaving away over number. I didn't know you could do math, Drew Klein. You'll find President Drew Klein. You can do math. I was stunned.
At a very basic level. It's one of my secret skills.
And you've actually got some fascinating numbers that most of the media have completely overlooked about COVID. I think your numbers were all going to die. Death rate 100%. Is that what you had?
So one of the interesting things.
Wait, don't get to that. You have some interesting numbers. We're going to hold that right there. And we're going to get to those interesting numbers. See, this is called the tease in the old podcast biz, because we got to talk about the budget. We have not spoken since the budget passed. And I was wondering if you had some takeaways from what the legislature did last week.
Well, I want to thank you for showing our readers that we really don't, our readers, our listeners, that we don't script this at all. This is absolutely just you and me riffing. So that's the way this podcast goes. You just got to roll with it.
That is right, Drew Klein. We are just riffing. And I will be waiting for your next anecdote.
Go ahead. As I take a sip of my Sun Drop, sponsored by.
But I got to stop right there. Do you know the classic story about, I think he was from Colorado, that he was one of the U.S. senators who was swept into office by Reagan in 1980, you know, this huge wave, people who never thought they'd win won. Yeah. And the guy actually is making a speech on the floor of the Senate, and he's got his, you know, because back then there's no teleprompters, whatever. And that is why the most important thing for my voters is turn page.
Yeah.
One of the classics of all time.
Yeah. So we are totally riffing here, unscripted. So, you know, making it worth your while to listen to this podcast. So where were we? What are we going? Budget numbers?
There's stuff in the budget that you think we should be paying attention to.
Well, there's so much stuff in the budget, and we actually haven't finished going through, like, breaking out a lot of the details. We'll do that as we go forward. But some of the top line numbers that I think are interesting that aren't getting reported, at least in percentage terms. So when we talk about the tax cuts, and everybody sort of reported the tax cuts, but when you look back at the business profits tax and business enterprise tax, going back to 2015, when all these tax cuts started, you kind of can look back and take these as one large tax rate reduction, because that's really what they were. It was a long multi-year process to ratchet those rates down. So the business profits tax has gone down by 10.5% since 2015. So in 6 years, taking that down by 10.5%, the business enterprise tax by 27% in 6 years. That's a sizable cut.
And not insignificant.
And the business enterprise tax, for if everybody's just listening to folks in the Twitter sphere or whatever, and you hear, oh, these tax cuts are for rich out-of-state corporations, not true. The business enterprise tax is primarily paid by smaller businesses. It sweeps in a lot of small local businesses, and 27% rate cut is good. And then you had the addition added to that of raising the filing threshold to $250,000. So, which incidentally was a Democratic proposal that was intended to be a replacement for the rate reductions, but the Republicans just took it and included it with the rate reductions. So it's extra tax cuts all around for everybody in the business. So I thought that was really interesting. We are still, despite those rate cuts, ranked pretty high in business taxes, though. So New Hampshire still gets a lot of its revenue from business taxes. When you look around New England, it's hard to compare apples to apples because we have a flat business tax rate, and a lot of other states have graduated for progressive business tax rates, but we still have among the highest tax rates in the country for businesses. So, but they've come down quite a bit in the last 5 years, which is good.
And I read a piece in another publication, you were cheating on us at New Hampshire Journal, and you were talking about the swept tax and the property tax relief. Can you explain that in small words that I can understand?
Oh, gosh. So let me just do a really quick, so I won't get every bit of detail in here, but the statewide education property tax is a local property tax that the state then legally claims a certain portion of. And so the state has given communities a $100 million tax cut. That is a direct property tax cut. You will see some analysts say, well, you cut that property tax rate, but then you didn't replace, but then you cut some other aid to localities, so it's going to wind up being a property tax increase. That is not right, because the aid that they focus on was not entirely, they cut, it was something like $47 million. Basically, they just came up with a different formula and added another $35 million after cutting the $47 million, so it's not as big a cut as they claimed. And there are additional portions of aid to localities, including, and this gets to the bottom line of the state budget, so the meals and rooms tax, 9%, cut down to 8.5%. So historically, that to get the meals and rooms tax years ago, the state was supposed to share a large portion of that revenue with localities, and it's never shared as much as it said it was going to share. So these budget writers went and increased the percentage of meals and room tax revenue that is shared with local governments. It was 22%. They increased it to 30%. Mm-hmm. So that's about a $50 million increase in aid that will go to local towns. And here's the interesting thing. They created what's basically a dedicated fund. So they took that money, that 30% now is revenue that is no longer categorized as state revenue. It is now considered belonging to local governments. So budget writers can no longer touch that going forward. So what that did is it took that revenue off the books, and it took that money off the books. So the state can't spend that money on state projects. So that's a big part of why the state budget bottom line is reduced by $172 million. So the actual, it's not like the budget writers went through and slashed $172 million from different programs. There were reductions in other programs, but a big part of it was that moving that money. But what that means is, again, that money is no longer available for state to spend. It is basically given to local governments. And so it's interesting to me to hear the same people who are complaining about downshifting costs onto local governments, and you hear this refrain a lot, are now complaining that the state took money to dedicate to local governments and gave them this revenue. So you just can't win either way.
Well, you can win if it's more money. And so, well, one thing I can do is small, easy to understand numbers. And here's an easy one. This budget spends more money K through 12 per pupil than has ever been spent before, or at least in modern life, certainly more than last year. And that is the magic phrase, Drew, that I don't know if media people just pretend they don't understand it. I don't know if people in the legislature just, if they have a mental issue with the phrase, maybe if it's two P's in a row, they can't do it. But per pupil spending is the only spending that matters. It is irrelevant if one school district spends $1 billion and the next one spends $1,000. If you don't know how many kids are in the schools, and this is higher per pupil spending. Also, I'm stunned, Drew, at the number of people who haven't figured out yet that under the new EFA plan that just passed, the student who chooses to leave, say, Bedford to go to a nearby school district or go to a charter school or go to a private school, whatever they choose to do, they only take the state portion of the money with them. So, let's use as a thumbnail, $20,000 per student, which is a little high, but not that high.
No, that's right. You're right on.
Ballpark, yeah. About 5,000 will go with the student, which means about 15,000 will be left. And so people are saying, you're taking money away from school. Whoa. You have fewer kids to teach and more money per capita to teach them with. And I don't understand how people can go. Look, if I ran a restaurant, and you told me, look, here's the deal. It's normally 100 customers and $1,000. We're going to have 70 customers and $900. I'll take that deal every day. That's a great deal for me. But they don't seem to understand that or don't want to.
Well, because it's really about control, not about money. So here's
one. Do I have the math right that that's what happens? The schools end up with net more money per student if students leave with the FA.
Well, so here's how it works. If you're talking about educating a kid, so the local public school will educate your kid for about $20,000. Depends on the district. Some are a little more, some are less. The EFA will educate your kid for about $4,600. So the savings is about 77% savings. So we're going to, through an EFA program, we'll be educating a kid for about 23% of the cost that we currently pay to educate a kid. That's savings. That's right. How it works. It's not losing money. It's not costing districts money. Okay. It is a savings for taxpayers.
Okay. I just got to ask, how is what you just said any different from what I just said before you said that?
Well, I just said it with a lot more flair and detail.
Okay. I'll leave it at that. There are some other things in the budget as well that are not fiscal. And I will say that as the political fights continue, I am very confused by the political stratagem from New Hampshire Democrats. I really don't understand it. My bet is, if you look at the data, people in New Hampshire like tax cuts and they don't like tax increases. So why would Democrats almost uniformly vote for both? You know, the data show that most people in New Hampshire think that there should be some restriction on abortion. They don't like it, you know, all the way up to the last day, you know, 5.5 months, right in the wheelhouse with the available polling. Democrats voted against it and are attacking it strenuously every day. The polling from the UNH is a little bit mixed, but based on what we've seen around the country, the people who are motivated by the issue of critical race theory and the idea of schools teaching that their white students are inherently part of a white supremacist culture and that their white parents are part of a white supremacist culture, that's not popular with people who vote. And I don't want to be the person to point this out, but New Hampshire is like 93% white. So from a purely political standpoint, not arguing who's right and wrong, what I have seen in the budget and in the aftermath of the budget, Drew Klein, is that Democrats are betting that these issues that right now are polling poorly, they seem to believe are going to turn around or are going to pay off for them in the long run? Or what am I misunderstanding?
Well, you're the political guy and I'm the policy guy. Okay. So, but I will give you my amateur thinking on this. A couple of things. So one, political parties now are really fundraising machines. Mm. And so what we're seeing from both the left and right, but particularly in the party out of power, you see their behavior shift to focus on fundraising. Mm-hmm. So what you have is left-wing activists, and this is true with activist groups who have 501c4s, and they go out there, and that's a specific type of nonprofit group where you get right. to lobby and everything, for the listeners who don't know. So they want to gin up a lot of fundraising and excitement and anger and rage and that. So, and you see the political parties doing this too. So in New Hampshire, you have the party out of power that has focused for really the last year, and we've talked a little bit about this before, in kind of strange ways. So instead of working in the legislative process to try to force compromise, to try to force uncomfortable votes that will win over middle of the road voters, you see a strategy that's focused on riling up your base, playing to the extremes, getting your base angry, and tweeting, and all that seems to me to be focused on fundraising mm-hmm. and base activism.
Okay, well, let me ask you about policy then, because you're very familiar with the new law that was part of the budget, the anti-discrimination law.
Yeah.
Over the weekend, the leader of the Democratic Party in the House, not some fringe person, I don't want to name any names, Sherry Frost, but the leader of the minority, Representative Cushing, said New Hampshire might as well hang a whites only sign from passing that legislature. That was his phrase. And the Democratic House caucus sent out a press release calling the bill racist in the statement from the there's a controversy. Several members of the governor's commission on diversity resigned, claiming that the law as passed will not let them fight for equity and will not let them address issues of discrimination. You're familiar with the law.
Those are all lies or misrepresentations or misunderstandings of the way the law. Now, I'm not a fan of outlawing things. I mm-hmm. probably, you know, if it was up to me, I would have taken a different approach on this stuff. But if you just read the language of the law, it does not outlaw discussion. It does not outlaw conversations about these issues. It doesn't outlaw implicit bias training. None of those things that people are saying it will do is true. It says, and you, thankfully, at New Hampshire Journal, have published the actual language so people can go read it for themselves, but it basically prevents students from being taught that particular groups, gender, race, sex, are inherently, meaning by birth, racist, sexist, or oppressive. So it doesn't prevent discussing that idea. And that's a really important distinction. It never says, well, you can't discuss what these ideas right. are. It says you can't teach that this is fact.
Right. So that's so I'm going to interrupt you there. To dumb this down.
Yeah.
It's the difference between saying the Civil War was fought in part of the issue of slavery because many Southern whites believed that Black people were inferior versus saying, and they were right. That's the difference.
But you know, another thing that I think is part of this discussion that's really unfortunate is the way we have come to use the term racism mm-hmm. and racist. Those terms are used to mean a much broader range of things than they used to mean. So, you know, racist used to be taken to mean, you believe that your race is inferior, is superior to another. Mm-hmm. And it is being used to mean bias and prejudice now. And those are not synonyms. And I think that's an unfortunate thing that we have in the conversation now. But the ACLU and the resignation en masse from the Governor's Diversity Council, the only thing I can think of is in Life of Brian, the crack suicide squad running up to Brian and opening their stomachs and committing Harry Carey en masse and then collapsing. Because again, as we get in, this is a great publicity stunt, but if you are intent on shaping the conversation, wouldn't it be better to remain on the commission and continue to fight for your ideas and shape the conversation than pull a one-time publicity stunt and walk away? And yeah, you get some headlines for that day, but now you're out of the conversation and the governor gets to appoint other people to fill your place. Is he going to appoint more people who think like you? Probably not. So this is not a good long-term strategy.
No. And, you know, I've covered it before. This is not a message that works in a state like New Hampshire. I don't know that would work anywhere. But I want to wrap up before we get to our conversation with tax expert Bill Ardinger about the Supreme Court refusing to hear New Hampshire's case on the cross-border state scam, tax scam. I want to ask you about another area where the polls seem to show, you know, what people like. A pretty surprising poll, I thought, that showed a huge number of people, both in New Hampshire and nationwide, like the idea of ending unemployment benefit, unemployment bonus benefits. And I want to be clear, that's not ending unemployment. New Hampshire still does it. Massachusetts still does it. It's that ending that extra $300 a week that they were juicing the system with. And, you know, Drew, it's the cynic within us wants to say, oh, once you give people money, they're never going to want to take it back. You know, you're never going to win by taking away people's free stuff. But it looks to me like maybe Governor Sununu and the other Republican presidents, governors around the country just did.
Well, it gives me some hope that this sort of old-fashioned American idea that you should be self-supporting and we will help you get there, but ultimately in the end, you need to become self-sufficient. That's not faded away yet. And I think that's pretty encouraging. It's not surprising to me at all that you would have a majority of Americans say, yeah, you know, we believe in giving a guy a little bit of help, you know, when he's down and he needs it, but that shouldn't be permanent. And if there are jobs available, you need to get a job.
You're far too positive. But let me tell you why this number has plunged. It's because people are going to restaurants waiting for an hour in the food and going, what the hell? Stop giving these people money. I need someone to work over here. Come on. And they're standing in line waiting for, what do you mean there's no cashiers? Dude.
Well, imagine if you're, so the people I have great sympathy for right now are waiters, wait staff.
No kidding.
I mean, I know folks in the restaurant business who have had to schedule two people on a shift that normally has eight. I mean, it's we ate out this weekend and the poor wait staff was overwhelmed and we were just as polite as we could be and suddenly there was no problem. You know, there was a long wait. It was just, they did a great job, but they're really overworked. But imagine the poor person on the factory floor, you know, who there are maybe 20 empty, kiosks or whatever, you know, positions on the factory floor, you know, because, and you're having to, you know, work extra hard. I mean, the shortage of labor in all fields is just particularly blue collar fields, but even white collar businesses. I mean, you look at, you know, medical profession and various professionals with college degrees. Nobody can find anybody.
So we promised that you were going to share these new numbers that you've got at jbartlett.org. Yes. So really what quickly. Are they?
Yeah. So apparently I'm the only one who has ever asked this question, which is really frustrating. We decided to go through the state and Joint Information Center and ask how many people, going back as far back as you can go, who've contracted COVID, who've been an official COVID case, who've been hospitalized and who've died of COVID in New Hampshire, were vaccinated versus unvaccinated. Well, the state ran the numbers for us, and they went back to February 1st, which is when the state says we started to get people who were fully vaccinated.
Right.
So going back to February 1st, 99% of New Hampshire's 33,700 COVID cases have been unvaccinated people, and 98% of COVID deaths have been unvaccinated people. So 236 COVID deaths since February 1st, five were people who had been vaccinated. Hospitalizations, they don't keep track of total hospitalizations of COVID patients. Mm-hmm. But since then, I mean, in fact, you go back the whole time, only 15 people have been hospitalized with COVID in New Hampshire who've been fully vaccinated. So it's pretty strong evidence that the vaccines work at doing what they're supposed to do.
I don't know. I don't trust that there COVID mRNA. I'm going to get me no shot or whatever. I don't know. All I will say is the frightening number of the week is a new poll that shows that 95% of Democrats in the United States say they don't believe the pandemic is over. And I'm like, what's it going to take? You know, how low are the numbers going to have to get? And the fact is there are a bunch of people who really have no problem with mask wearing going on ad infinitum. I just talked to someone today who has a medical professional in his family. And she said, you know, we've had a really easy flu season because people stayed away from each other. That means when people start getting out and get colds and flu again, it's going to be bad. I think we need to make everyone wear masks because just for one more season, because the cold and flu season is going to be bad. I'm like,
well, you have some kids camps that are saying, look, no masks, no, you're fine. And then some kids camps are still looking at making kids wear masks outdoors. It's nuts. And it goes back to my theory that we're one of the biggest divides we have in this country is not necessarily left or right, mm-hmm. but it falls left or right. It is people who are willing to take risks and people who aren't.
Yep.
And that can explain a lot of it. But I do follow Ala Pundit on Twitter.
Oh, absolutely. He's great.
So there's a, for those of you on Twitter, Ala Pundit is very good. And he had a tweet the other day that about that poll who, and his comment was, look, it looks like now there are two countries in the US. There's the people who think the pandemic is over and the people who don't. And they're each behaving in the opposite way that they ought to behave based on their belief. So
anyway. That's a great note. And on that note, let's check in with tax expert Bill Ardinger, who's going to let us know what, if anything, New Hampshire can do to get its money back from Massachusetts. And I want to apologize in advance. He was actually on vacation on an island, not an exotic one, but one near Massachusetts. But the connection wasn't great. It's not terrible audio, but it's not up to the usual high standards mandated by the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. So I apologize. So when you want to know what is going on with New Hampshire and its lawsuit against Massachusetts and cross-border taxation, there's only one person to go to. Unfortunately, he wasn't available. So we've got Bill Ardinger. Prominent local tax attorney in the Granite State. Bill, thanks for your time on the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be with you.
First of all, I have to say, how do you, tax attorney is like, you know, it's the gag, like who's the most boring guy in the room, tax attorney. How do you like being a tax attorney?
I actually love being a tax attorney, Michael. You're right. It sounds at first glance like filling out pieces of paper and tax returns and using a calculator with numbers, but the way I got into tax law was as when I was a student at the University of New Hampshire in college, I was elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives, which you know is an unusually large house, so it's not that big a deal to get elected. But as a 19-year-old, it was a wonderful experience, and I had the good fare of being appointed to the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee that deals with tax issues. And there, what I saw is that these complicated issues, technical words that seemed to be almost impossible to understand, really had real impacts for people.
Right.
You know, whether they're sisters in the North Country who own a farm, or whether it's a young person starting up a new business in Salem. Every little teeny word that you change in this tax law has potential impacts in real life and on real persons. And so I found tax law to be unbelievably deeply interesting.
I have to have a cocktail party, Bill, just so I can invite you. I'm going to do it just for that reason. But it actually does have real impact, obviously, on people who live in New Hampshire, work in Massachusetts, and found themselves working from home during COVID, only to discover that they were still being taxed as though they worked in Massachusetts. Could you talk a little bit about what New Hampshire wanted the Supreme Court to do, and what did they say no to?
As you know, one of the most shocking developments in our lives over the last couple of years was the rise of COVID and responses to COVID. As you know, every day the news challenging and threatening development. Well, in the strange area of tax policy, we had similar types of impacts from COVID. In last year, when you'll remember, as the COVID threat grew, states, including New Hampshire and Massachusetts and others, decided to kind of tell citizens, hey, stay where you are. And what that meant is, look, you all can work from home and not come into the office, please. That was a request and in fact, a mandate. And Massachusetts in April not only had that mandate, April of last year, 2020, had that mandate in effect. Governor Baker and his administration and through his tax department said, oh, by the way, even if you are a resident of another state, say New Hampshire, and you did work in Massachusetts before the pandemic, we're going to treat it as if you're continuing to work in Massachusetts at your employer's location, even though we know you're actually working at home, from your home in New Hampshire, for example, not at your work business. And so Massachusetts said, we're going to treat it as if you still owe Massachusetts state income tax, as if you were working in Massachusetts. That had a big effect on New Hampshire residents who, as you know, Michael, they were working in Hampshire for almost a year,
sure,
or more in some cases, at the request of the governor and of Governor Baker. And yet Massachusetts said, you're going to still owe Massachusetts income tax as if you worked in Massachusetts the entire time. And so when that rule really bit, the governor of the state of New Hampshire, Governor Sununu, and his administration said, this should not stand. This is effectively Massachusetts saying, when we invite our residents in New Hampshire to stay at home, work at home, play at home, we say one of the things you get in New Hampshire is no income tax on your wages. And Governor Sununu directed his attorney general to file a lawsuit against Massachusetts in the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge that. And in fact, Michael, for the listeners, I am engaged as a lawyer to help the New Hampshire Department of Justice in that lawsuit,
right,
and have been engaged.
Now, before we get to what it was that New Hampshire wanted the court to hear, the specific challenges and the nature of the challenges, what did the Supreme Court decide? Because my understanding is that their decision had nothing to do with the validity or lack of validity of New Hampshire's complaints. It had to do with whether or not the court would, under its own rules, take such a case.
Michael, you're a tax lawyer. You're absolutely right. Where what New Hampshire did at the direction of Governor Sununu is file a lawsuit. The only place that the state of New Hampshire is allowed under our Constitution to file a lawsuit against another state in the original jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court, our highest court in the land. And we did that and filed that, but the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't take every case that is filed there. The traditional paradigm case that the court takes in a state versus a state is a case where a state says, hey, that's our border, and this state is trying to cross into our border. Come on, U.S. Supreme Court, resolve our dispute. But it's not mandatory. It's discretionary. Mm-hmm. So what the U.S. Supreme Court did just yesterday is issue an order saying to New Hampshire and Massachusetts, hey, states, and New Hampshire specifically, we are not going to, at this time, take your challenge as a state of New Hampshire against the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We're going to reject your request to bring this case in our original jurisdiction, it's called. But that rejection has nothing to do with the merits, the real Hampshire's claim, which is our citizens were being harmed in violation of the Constitution of the United States by the Commonwealth's rule. And so that still exists. That claim still exists. The claim has not been denied. It hasn't been rejected. All that was rejected was New Hampshire's request to sue Massachusetts in the U.S. Supreme Court.
And I think that's one reason why Governor Sununu and others in his camp have pointed out that it was the Biden administration and the Solicitor General that specifically asked the court to make that decision. So I have two last questions for you, and I really appreciate your time. To be honest, everybody, we're bothering poor Bill Ardinger on his vacation, and he's agreed to do this much against his will. But my last two questions are, I know calling what the Supreme Court might do at any time is, you know, impossible. You cannot look into a crystal ball. Some of the recent rulings that were, you know, 9-0 shocked people, for example, that you could do that in this, you know, allegedly divided age. But if you had to look at the case New Hampshire was making, if it could get it in front of the Supreme Court, what part do you think would be the strongest, the most likely to get the court to step in and say, you know what, we just can't let Massachusetts do this?
Just the basic fairness of the situation. There is, in my view, no way to stand up and say that Massachusetts' assertion of its income tax over residents of New Hampshire who are not working in Massachusetts at the time, that is woefully unfair. That just simply as a matter of fairness. How can a state like Massachusetts or like California, for example, let's say California all of a sudden said to me, I'm a resident of New Hampshire, I never go to California, I'm not working in California. What if they sent me a letter saying, we have determined that you owe California non-resident, what would I do? I would say, that's unfair. And I'd file some kind of claim to stop it and to challenge it. And in this case, in my view, what Massachusetts was proposing, what had actually is asserted this tax in situations where they're asking New Hampshire residents to stay home, to protect public health, to not travel in Massachusetts and use their roads and use their fire protection. In that case, it is just fundamentally unfair to allow that state jurisdiction to tax another state citizen. Now, the complications, is it a violation of the Due Process Clause? Yes. Is it a violation of the Commerce Clause? I believe yes. What really comes down to, Michael, though, to me, is in this situation of unfairness, do you know where the buck stops in Massachusetts? We could fight all day in court.
Right.
We could have citizens of New Hampshire could hire lawyers. It's going to be expensive. It's going to take a long time. You've got to fight with the Massachusetts Department of Revenue. But at the very top of Massachusetts is Governor Charlie Baker,
right,
is Lieutenant Governor Karen Politoff, and is the Secretary Michael Heffernan of the Administrative and Finance Department, which controls the Massachusetts taxing function. Those three people are three of the sharpest, finest people whom I've ever met. And I would, as a citizen of New Hampshire, call on them, reverse the rule. We're here now. This state of emergency has ended in Massachusetts. It's right. over. We're back to the other rule, which said you don't get taxed for days you're working in New Hampshire. For why implement any more the penalty on New Hampshire residents who complied with their order to help public? Right now, I am one person, but I'm going to work with other folks in New Hampshire to call on these three leaders, Governor Baker, Lieutenant Governor Polito, and Secretary Mike Heffernan, to just simply take the action and reverse the terrible effects of this rule, which requires New Hampshire residents to pay Massachusetts tax when they stayed where they worked and they played in New Hampshire, not in Massachusetts. What should happen here, Michael?
Well, that's what should happen, but as a longtime resident of Massachusetts, I will tell you that their unofficial motto is no good deed goes unpunished. So I would not expect that. My last question is, you mentioned individuals. We have an op-ed by George Isaacson, one of the leading attorneys on tax issues involving out-of-state taxation, across-border taxation, internet taxation, et cetera. And he says that the door that's still open, thanks to the Supreme Court, is the door of individual taxpayers. And that, yes, a Massachusetts court would oversee this and likely, given the politics, would rule in Massachusetts' favor. But then that ruling would give you something to take to the Supreme Court and say, now you guys and gals need to get involved. Is that true?
It is absolutely true. George Isaacson is one of the great leaders in the legal field on trying to control and define what the extent of state tax jurisdictions are. Right now, where the U.S. Supreme Court has said to New Hampshire, we're not the right place for you to bring this lawsuit. The situation is now with every individual taxpayer in New Hampshire who gets some letter from Massachusetts that says you have to pay tax for time that you stayed, worked, and played in New Hampshire to pay tax to Massachusetts. Those new residents should fight. They should file a complaint back. They should say, I don't owe it. And ultimately, that process will go through the court system and get to the Supreme Court. Now, this is expensive. What I hope happens in New Hampshire now is what has happened in other situations, where there will be groups of taxpayers who will come together. There will be some who have great resources, some who have less resources, and hopefully to get this case to the U.S. Supreme Court where it should come. Michael, remote work is not going away. And in these states, like New York State, like Massachusetts, and other states who
right.
say, look, we're going to tax you even though you're not working in our state, they're going to have to be stopped. And the only way that it's going to stop it is either Congress is going to have to pass a law that says you can't do it. And remember, New York is one of these states. So Senator Schumer in New York, a Democrat senator from New York, he is not going to let that legislation happen
right.
on his watch or the U.S. Supreme Court. And we got to get it there somehow because it's basically unfair.
Listen, you remote work, you can't even get away from remote podcasts when you're on vacation, Bill Ardinger. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for letting us tear you away from your family for a few minutes. And I hope one of my children grows up one day to be a tax attorney. That's how much you've affected me with this call.
So that audio wasn't too bad, right, Drew? Drew?
The floggings will commence after the recording stops.
We've got a lot of great content. And where can we find it on the interwebs?
Hey, there's a lot of good stuff up right now at jbartlett.org. That's the Josiah Bartlett's website. You can go there. And when you go there and look up all of our good content, you can click on the Contact Us page and sign up for our email newsletter, which now comes out on Mondays. And sign up for that. It's good stuff.
It's changed my entire weekly schedule. I just want you to know. But you can find nhjournal.com. And if you're not sure what we're writing about, just follow any angry progressive in the Granite State. They are tweeting our stuff out all the time. And so all I got to say
they are your best PR department, by the way. I don't know how much you pay them, but
You know what's so funny is how much trouble you can get into and how much controversy you can cause just by quoting people accurately. And that's all. That's our motto at NH Journal. He's Drew Klein with the Josiah Bartlett Center. I'm Michael Graham with New Hampshire Journal. Thanks so much again for listening to this edition of the New Hampshire Journal podcast.